My next guest has just published a book that offers nuanced and considered analysis of an issue that often gets treated as just a blunt object. Of course, the founders wanted to keep church and state completely separate, many of us say. Others insist this country only exists through the grace of God, who wanted it to be founded by and for Christians. Dr. Stephen K. Green brings scholarship and dispassionate analysis to the pages of Separating Church and State, a History. And I am pleased, glad, to have him back with us today on State of Belief Radio. Steve, thank you for joining us. While it's tempting for us to focus on opposing Bartonian efforts to create a foundational link between Christianity and our national identity, I read you as saying part of the problem is a lack of clarity dating back to the founding of the nation. Is that fair to say?
You're correct. What I tried to do in the book was to not necessarily get polemical, but to address this question that some say that we hear this frequently, that separation of church and state is not listed in the Constitution. So consequently, it is a fabricated concept and should not necessarily be adhered to. At the same time, different surveys reveal that approximately two-thirds to as close as three-quarters of Americans actually believe in some concept of separation of church and state. And so we have this tension that exists within our culture, a tension that exists within the law. What I do in the book is I go back and try to establish the bona fides of the concept of separate spheres. And that goes all the way back to the Middle Ages. It goes back to the Catholic Church battles with the different emperors of medieval Europe. It certainly has roots in the Reformation. This idea of separating the two regimes has a very long history and a long tradition. But that can mean many things, because even though Calvin believed in separate spheres, everybody knows that Geneva was not the most liberal place during his reign, and that certainly Puritans and other Reformed Christians who came out of Calvinism didn't really practice religious tolerance, let alone religious freedom. So it can mean many things to many people.
Was it a lack of clarity in the writing itself, or a lack of agreement among the founders that left us in this situation?
I think there was a fundamental level of agreement among the founders. They had experienced 150 years of repressive church establishments. Now, in New England, they believe that their religious establishment was not anywhere as bad as the religious establishment in the southern colonies, which is the Church of England. But at the same time, they were very restrictive. And there's one thing that I think was a pretty consistent trend, is that we need to disentangle the realms of government from the power of the church. I mean, what I say in this book, and I've said many times in other contexts, is one thing we have to acknowledge, and I don't think can be refuted, is a phenomenal sea change occurred within a very short period of time. In 1776, at the time of the Declaration of Independence, and the time that Congress invited states to form themselves as states. Out of the 13 new states, 9 of them had some form of religious establishment. Within a short 10 years, at the cusp of the writing of the Constitution, that number had switched. You now had 10 states, because now you had Vermont, 10 states that had disestablished, and 4 states that were retaining some type of establishment, but they were on the defensive. They didn't even want to call what they had as religious establishments. So there's a fair degree of consensus on that level. Where the consensus, I think, broke down is what does that mean beyond these formal, technical, legal establishments of religion, of preferential treatment for some religion over others? And there was a variety of ideas and concepts out there.
Where did the idea itself originate? Was it a King George thing or something more philosophical than that?
Well, I think for the founders, I've been accused of being a Whig historian, which that means you kind of glorify the founding sometimes. And I actually think we were extremely fortunate, notwithstanding the limitations and the tunnel vision that many of the founders had with respect to inclusion of people of color or women within the political construct. Still, they were highly educated. They knew their history. And they relied extensively on Enlightenment and Whig scholars from the latter part of the 17th century, early 18th century. John Locke was probably the most influential philosopher for the founding generation. And he wrote extensively about separate spheres, about keeping the two apart, and that government had no business in trying to make people to be religious because it violated rights of conscience. And that was an extremely powerful theme that resonated throughout the founding period. And it wasn't just Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, the people we hold out, who followed Locke. I have a 4 3-volume set of sermons from the founding period. And you go and you see these sermons during the Revolutionary War of these Calvinist ministers, and they're quoting John Locke as being the be-all and end-all when it comes to this idea of natural rights and keeping government out of religious affairs. So long story short, there was a fair degree of consensus that establishments were wrong and the government should stay out of religious business. And so within that, you had a variety of opinions on how far that goes one direction or the other.
So could they have done it better, considering all the pressures and disagreements in play? Did any of the founders anticipate the challenges that we are facing today?
No, not at all. I've just finished a draft monograph of my next book, which is a dual biography of Jefferson and Madison on religious freedom. And you look at that, and what you come away from it, and one thing I think is they did a pretty damn good job with what they had, with the headwinds that they were facing. Second, to quote Justice Felix Frankfurter from the 1940s, he called separation of church and state a spacious conception. And what he meant by that, it was a conception that would grow, that would evolve over time and encompass things that the founders had not necessarily considered at that period of time. And in this new book I've been working on, I've probably read at least 200 to 300 letters, correspondence back between Madison and Jefferson over many years of their collaboration. And you can see clearly within at least their conception that they had not arrived at the perfect formula, that this was a work in progress. And not to get off on a different issue, but this is one of the things that really bothers me about original meaning originalists like Justice Scalia and some of the justices who are on the Supreme Court today. They believe they can go back and kind of freeze in time the meaning of certain constitutional phrases and principles and then extrapolate those to the future. And you go back and look, and I don't think there are any in the founding period, not just Jefferson and Madison, who believed in freezing these things in time. They believed it was a evolving constitution.
Mm-hmm. What's the confusion between the wall metaphor and the establishment clause? Is there real ambiguity there?
Well, interestingly enough, Thomas Jefferson, who we give credit to at least familiarizing us with this wall of separation between church and state from his 1802 letter to the Danbury Baptists. He only used that metaphor that one time, so far as we can know. Even though the Supreme Court picked up on that in 1789 and then again in 1947. But you can see in his writings that he at least reaffirms it needs to be some kind of strong line, some boundary that does separate the spheres. And we have to see James Madison, even though he never uses the exact phrase wall of separation, he uses other phrases, barrier, line, etc. And he talks more about church-state separation in his later writings than actually Thomas Jefferson does, using that phrase. Mm-hmm. So I think actually the wall metaphor has been a distraction. In a previous book, when I was looking at more of the 1940s and 1950s, I went to the Library of Congress and went through all the papers and early drafts of these opinions by the Supreme Court justices. And in the initial drafts of the 1947 opinion, when Justice Black resurrects this wall metaphor, it's not in his earlier drafts. Hmm. He actually kind of added it at the last minute in response to Justice Wiley Rutledge's dissenting opinions. And he beefed up his majority opinion and used the wall metaphor. I'm not saying it's a throwaway line, mm-hmm. but it just wasn't as necessary for the underlying principle. What has happened, though, is religious conservatives and political conservatives has seized upon this and actually elevated this idea of a impenetrable wall in a way that I don't think Jefferson or Madison ever intended the language to mean.
Looking at it from a modern perspective, what are the most important things that we need to know about the actual intent of the founders of this issue?
Well, again, I think the most thing we need to bear in mind is that they agreed on certain fundamental principles about the rights of conscience. And actually, they believed that these were natural rights, not necessarily God-given rights in the way some people misconstrue when we talk about natural rights theories. They believed that religious equality was a fundamental principle. And that was a hard one back then to actually promote that. But most of them believed that religious equality was necessary. They wanted to avoid religious dissension, something that Justice Breyer has talked a lot about in his opinions. That's an extremely potent theme in the founding period that we need to relieve, because that had been the source. I mean, you know, we're talking about close to 250 years ago. And in the recent memory, so to speak, mm-hmm. of the founders, were the wars of religion. Hmm. Those were within their grandparents' memories. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, religious dissension was a really big thing for them. Mm-hmm. And then forced support of someone else's religion through forced taxation. Those were all things that almost everybody agreed upon mm-hmm. during that time. So in that sense, I think we can go back and look at these kind of general principles yeah. and use those today. What I'm concerned about is what Justice Alito and some of the more conservatives on the Supreme Court are doing is they're going back and kind of cherry-picking history. I think it's highly disappointing. It's highly destructive to our constitutional heritage to do this. I think it is in many ways politically driven, that separation of church and state has become, like other legal concepts, has become almost a partisan idea, whereas it was not something Republicans supported separation of church and state up until recently. Baptists supported separation of church yeah. and state up until recently. And so I find that highly troubling that it has become this kind of divisive issue. As a law professor and a lawyer, as well as a historian, what I find also very perplexing is the conservative members of the Supreme Court are attacking separation of church and state like it was forced upon them by some alien force, instead of being a concept that they embraced 50 years ago and less than 50 years ago. Mm. And so in that sense, it's very distressing to see the attacks on this concept. Yeah. And then more specifically, how they're going about and kind of just changing core jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. I mean, throughout most of the history, this idea that you don't fund religion was mandated by the Establishment Clause. Yeah. Recently, within the last 5 years, the Supreme Court has said, if you don't fund religion, then you're discriminating against religion. You're showing hostility toward religion. Yeah. And the Establishment Clause doesn't stand, shouldn't bar that. And so they're kind of turning the world upside down yeah. on some of these fundamental ideas that we have.
Steve, I wonder if we might lean on your expertise in helping us think about a current hot topic. The Supreme Court is considering the issue of prayer at public schools, sporting events. You've argued a number of cases before the High Court yourself, including one in 2000 that resulted in a ban on just this kind of school-sanctioned prayer. So you're the perfect person to ask why the issue is so important, how the justices got it right back then, and what's at stake today in Bremerton.
Yeah, this is about a football coach in Bremerton High School outside Seattle who has insisted that he has a protected right at the conclusion of a football game, when it is still clearly a school-sponsored event, to go on the football field and pray and to invite anyone who wants to, which basically means all of his teammates, to come on and pray with him on the middle of the football field. Right. If you and I were at that game and we rushed onto the football field at the end of the game, the police would drag us off the field. So Mr. Kennedy is not going onto the football field in the capacity as a private citizen. He's going on in the capacity that he is there as a coach, which is a public employee. And so he's engaging in very demonstrative religious activity. It would be like my seventh grade daughter's teacher in one of her classes saying, "Oh, I'm going to all of a sudden stand up and pray and read the Bible out loud to you, a captive audience." Yeah. And I have a free exercise right to do it there and then. And if you say the Establishment Clause prohibits that, you're discriminating against me. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt, this is turning the 1962 and 1963 school prayer cases on their head.
Yeah.
A football coach, more than probably any teacher, is someone who the students will look up to, who has subtle coercive authority over the students. So consequently, to say that there's nothing else going on here, all I'm doing is praying, and I have a right to do that. Again, I don't think it doesn't pay any respect to the facts.
And what else does a likely ruling against the district open the door to going forward?
Well, I think it opens the door to certainly more religious activity in public schools, where you have students who, again, are very impressionable. There's a lot of peer pressure to participate in these activities. You tell me where the line is between demonstrative prayer and then proselytizing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know where that line is. And so it's going to be very hard to start making these fine distinctions once you kind of open the door and say that teachers have these rights. The other thing I'm concerned about, it becomes very majoritarian, that we have an increasingly religious diversity within this country, more and more Muslim students, students of Asian religions, right? How are they going to feel
right.
when their role models, their teachers are now engaging in, and to be honest, let's call it what it is. The people who are going to do it are going to be evangelical
right.
Christians.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not going to be a wide variety of religion being practiced outwardly in public schools by public yeah. school employees.
With the religious right and some groups of religious people decided that they weren't getting anywhere by trying to talk about religious freedom with other people, they just defined it again. It's not like what's in what we see as religious freedom. They just redefined it. How are we ever going to get people to understand what religious freedom is? And that's why I want to ask you, how do you define religious freedom?
I actually use these words very technically. I do normally not use the word religious liberty, because I see that being as more of a kind of a personal right. I have the liberty interest to keep you from imposing your values or whatever on me, right? Religious freedom, in my mind, is a larger concept that includes not only religious liberty, the right to practice your religion free from government coercion, etc. It's a condition. It's a state of being. It is the way society operates. And religious freedom means religious equality. It means religious respect, right? It means freedom of conscience. And it means, again, separation of church and state. All of that, in my mind, is under the umbrella of religious freedom. What I fear has happened is that religious conservatives are taking the term religious freedom and giving the most narrow version of that. And they're jettisoning from this idea of religious freedom, religious respect, religious toleration for others. Mm-hmm. And so it's religious freedom for me. But when it comes to other concerns, other values, and even non-religious values, like respect for LGBTQ community, right? For non-discrimination laws, all of those become secondary to my religious freedom, very narrowly defined.
Dr. Stephen K. Green is professor of law, director of the Center for Religion, Law, and Democracy, and affiliated professor of history and religious studies at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. His important past books include Inventing a Christian America, The Myth of the Religious Founding. Dr. Green's latest is titled Separating Church and State, A History, just published by Cornell University Press. Steve, thank you for taking this important topic on and for being with us again on State of Belief Radio. You're always welcome with your insights.
Thank you. My pleasure.